I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Syria, the old keystone of the Arab Middle East, is a warning sort of failed state, smashed like a piñata these last 8 years by its own government and by raiders from near and far. Syria, the whole world's proxy war zone, in its own civil war too. From the standpoint of imperial management, Syria is the epic failure of our age, as The Guardian put it. But maybe it's not too late, before the descent to barbarism is complete, to speak of the misery of Syrian civilians, women and children, people and culture that go back to antiquity. Syria, in endless cell phone videos now, is hellfire and human agony every day, a model of unchecked brutality that is teaching the world something, no matter that we pretend to look away. We're engaging young Syrian voices this hour on the futures that they see unfolding. But first, the one-off voice and eyes of the artist, journalist, Molly Crabapple, who is drawn to all sorts of stories you'd be happy not to hear. She spoke with us this week about the lure of Syria for her, for years now.
I suppose what has always attracted me is I always look for stories of smart people who are in some way up against the world. You know, people who, yes, they're victimized and oppressed by the war or by the dictatorship. Yes, they are. But they're also people who are skeptical and who are brilliant and who are fighters. And I mean, I suppose one of the things that kept me coming back to Syria is that, especially at the start of the revolution, before it became corrupted into this hellish war against all that we see now, I mean, there were so many people, so many just tough people trying to create a politics of freedom and solidarity in so many places, not just in Aleppo, but also in places like Ghouta, in places like Douma, in small areas around the country, as well as in the largest ones. There was a blossoming of newspapers after the war. The cultural production that came out of the revolution is something that's almost impossible to quantify. It was like this, you know, long dammed up creativity was, you know, suddenly pouring out, even in exile, even after witnessing impossible violence, even after having been tortured. Those people were still there, and I wanted to keep telling their stories.
Your pen and ink and paintings, Molly, surface a nation of intense culture, antiquity, memory, detail, and they strike the heart in ways even that boy on the beach didn't. Paint us a picture, or just introduce us to some of these people and your conversations with them.
One woman that I'll always remember is an old woman that I met in Lebanon. She was just one of these, like, kind of working class Syrian women, like tough as nails. You know, she had been a mother. She had been someone who had done a lot of work. She had kept her family together against impossible odds. And I met her when she was living in an unfinished building in the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon with her husband, who had lost his legs because he was a diabetic and he didn't have access to insulin because of the war. And she was also living with her kids and her grandkids. And she was talking to me about how she had a son who was detained and she had no idea what had happened to him. And she had trained herself to be a field nurse during the war and was trying to, you know, patch up fighters and also people who had been shot up at protests. Government hospitals had become kind of death traps by this point. If you came into a government hospital with a gunshot wound, you might be arrested or tortured. In fact, it was likely you would be. And so people would go to these field clinics that were set up in supporters' houses instead. And, you know, she would tend to people there. And she was just so horrified at the world. And she was asking me why no one had intervened. And this is in 2013, and I had told her about Iraq, and I told her that I didn't believe America had the capacity to intervene for the better anywhere. And I always remember how she looked at me with just such, like, what the hell? Like, why should we have to suffer for what your idiot country did to destroy Iraq? And I don't know what the answer was for her, and I'll always remember just that tough, competent, impossibly brave and smiling woman living with her family in that unfinished building and still keeping her family together. Another person that I met that I thought really illustrated these sort of cruel dynamics was I met a young Palestinian guy named Walid at this camp. And Palestinians who fled the Zionist militias in 1948 and who fled to Syria were never given Syrian citizenship. And their children weren't given Syrian citizenship and their grandchildren weren't. So you have generations of people who have been born in Syria and are living in Syria and don't have Syrian passports. Now, what happened when these people, like Walid, fled the Syrian war was that Europe had no idea what to do with them. They were like, you don't have a Syrian passport. You're not a Syrian refugee. You're not eligible for the programs for Syrian refugees, even though you fled the very, very same war that everyone around you has. And so when I met Walid, he had been sleeping in this hideous transit camp in Samos, which was maybe four times over maximum population. He'd been sleeping there for 9 months with no end in sight. And eventually he was able to get to Holland with a smuggler. But the bureaucratic plight that he was in as a Palestinian only exacerbated everything that he suffered as someone who's fleeing the Syrian war.
Molly, do people look back to, you know, roads not taken or mistakes made? Do they have a notion of what relief could be in the future? What is it they're fixed on now?
I mean, most of my friends who are Syrian are immensely angry at the entire world. And I think anyone who looks at Syria looks at it as this sort of rolling Greek tragedy, where one decision leads to another decision that seemed inevitable at the time. But from that comes sort of a rolling spiral of disaster. Most people, at least who are pro-opposition, they look at the 2013 Obama red line moment as a major moment of betrayal, a moment basically saying that it was all right to kill Syrians as long as you used conventional weapons. And obviously also Bashar al-Assad continued to use chemical weapons after that. Another moment that some of my friends talk about is the decision of the opposition to arm itself. Though in many ways, I think that that was inevitable. I think that it's almost impossible to maintain a peaceful civil disobedience-based resistance in the face of so much violence and torture and even weaponized use of rape by the government.
You know, Syrians can be a byword in our culture now, Bedouins at best, terrorists at worst. I'm sure they're aware of those labels. What do they make of us?
I mean, I have friends that don't want to go to the West at all because they say, like, I don't want to go to those racist countries. I think most Syrians probably, if they had a choice, would like to go back to Syria. But the problem is that the Syria that they could live in does not exist. My friends can't go back to Syria, not because of ISIS, but because of the Assad government. These are people fleeing mandatory conscription that, you know, is gobbling up young men there, or also people who are likely on a list for detention, for arrest, and for torture. And that this just isn't something that's spoken about, right? It's so easy in the West to reduce this whole war to the war against ISIS. But in actuality, I mean, the main perpetrator of the violence is the government.
Your imagery is so distinctive, Molly. But it's not as if there were no images in this war. The boy on the beach may be the most memorable, but speak of the images that have become famous, like the boy on the beach, and the ones that might have been or should have been.
The Syrian war was probably one of the most recorded wars in history. It was one of the first wars that was fought in a country where people had camera phones and where every single part of the conflict was recorded on camera phones, including the most horrifying sides of the conflict. And there was footage that was taken by victims. There was footage that was taken by perpetrators. There was footage that was taken by drones. There was footage that was taken just by people witnessing snipers out in their street. It's had images made from every single angle. And in some ways, you would think, right, naively, that this would lead to there being more truth about the war. But actually, it's been quite the opposite. The glut of images instead served to, in some ways, destabilize the notions of truth. And I think one thing that keeps haunting me is the idea that many countries in the West and also neighboring countries would like Syria to be just stable enough that they could kick out the Syrian refugees and deport them back to Syria and not look too bad for doing it. And one of the things that horrifies me is that in the quest for this narrative of stability, the very real and hideous crimes that were committed will end up being forgotten. I mean, there is just a chlorine attack, right, on Sirakab just a few weeks ago. There was hideous, almost like extermination bombing campaigns on Ghouta and on Idlib. And these type of things will be swept under the rug and will be forgotten if there aren't very scrupulous journalists and if there isn't, you know, a very real campaign to fight for the truth of what happened in Syria, because the continuance of these type of massacres just isn't convenient for anyone in power to acknowledge anymore. I think that the internet has given us all the ability to see an infinite amount of horror around the world. I mean, not just Syria, right? Like the, you know, Rohingya genocide, the war in the Central African Republic, the rise of Nazism in America, and the sort of mass deportations that are starting to happen now. So I think that the way that humans just are made, right, is we only have so much empathy inside of us. If you had empathy for everything in the entire world, all of the horrors of the earth, you'd become the Buddha, as someone trying to detach themselves from the inevitability and immenseness of suffering. And I think that the internet, you can see all of that horror and you're just not equipped to deal with it, especially horror that you can't actually alleviate. And to me, that's why people look away, because there's so much horror. And what's very dangerous is that states are realizing that people are just sort of looking away from this horror, that people's ability to feel empathy and compassion is blown out, and they're taking that as a green light to publicly and gleefully do the worst things imaginable.
Molly Crabapple's book, forthcoming in May, about her Syria coverage, will be titled Brothers of the Gun. Coming up, Molly's collaborator, Marwan Hisham, among the rising generation of Syrian consciences. This is Open Source. Only in 1945 was Syria born as an independent nation out of the French Mandate after World War I and the Ottoman Empire before that. But Syrian identity is as old as civilization, and its cities like Aleppo and Damascus are among the oldest in the human record. There will be a future, too, one way or another, and our guests are working on it. Syrian-American Alia Malek wove together an acclaimed history of her family and nation. The New York Times called it essential reading. She titled it The Home That Was Our Country. Born in Baltimore, she was a U.S. government trial lawyer who moved to Damascus in 2011 to reclaim her grandmother's apartment in the early days of the Arab Spring. And then she stayed to write about the unfolding civil war. In unsigned reports for a variety of news outlets, Alia Malek, the thematic question in my mind this hour is, what do Syrians know and see and feel and remember and dread that we don't know about? Where do you begin?
Well, I started my book actually in 1889, and the last decades of the Ottoman Empire. I think part of the problem with getting the serious stories that we only seem to start it in 2011. And then it's, you know, when you sort of drop it in the story that late in the game, it's hard to really, it does become really inaccessible for a lot of people, and probably contributes to why, if they're not apathetic to this, this massive tragedy, at least sort of maybe more intimidated by it. I think what I wanted to do in my book, which, you know, actually, to tell you the truth, I have been wanting to write a book about Syria, sort of focused on my grandmother and this house for a long time, well before 2011. But my agent always said there wasn't a market for such a book. And she was right. There was really only a market for a book on Syria once it began to fall apart, once it began to come apart. That's when all of a sudden, you know, the outside world's interest is peaked. And, you know, I moved to Damascus at the beginning of the Arab Spring because I knew, you know, a lot of journalists would descend on the story from the outside, and they would take as their starting point 2011. But I thought there was a lot out there that both for us, for Syrians, and for outside readers that you know, wanted to sort of preserve.
So how do you tell people when they say, you know, guide me through this maze, what in the world is going on? Is it Syrians' fault? Is it our fault? Is it the French fault? Is it a post-colonial disease Is it a modern disease? Is it the Cold War? Where to begin?
I mean, kind of all of the above. And there's, you know, there are no easy answers in some ways. You know, the fault lines were laid around the end of the Ottoman Empire and what, you know, the sort of like truncated Syria that emerged from that and cut off really from the larger part of an empire that it had been a part of through the French Mandate, which sort of very effectively deepened some schisms that already existed in Syria in a social sense and sort of, you know, never under the Ottoman administration was sex sort of deemed a relevant way to govern. But it was the French that sort of saw Syria in a sectarian light and sort of gave sectarianism its earliest currency in the region. And then, you know, both the Cold War and then the regional sort of, battles for hegemony in the Middle East meant that Syria was a constant proxy for the competing ambitions of either global superpowers or regional superpowers.
Was it you that told us, Aliyah, that the French, I mean, that the Syrians after World War I didn't want the French at all? They would have preferred the Americans in the post-war settlement because we were so innocent of colonial roles in the Middle East.
Yes, at the end, as World War I was coming to an end, it was clear that the victors, essentially England and France, or the United Kingdom and France, were looking to divvy up the spoils from the Ottoman Empire. And they had set their sights on Iraq, on what we now see as modern-day Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine. And the Syrians, when they were given an opportunity to sort of address the peace conference, Paris Peace Conference at the end of World War I, knowing, you know, the first thing that they said, they articulated in the language of Woodrow Wilson and the idea of like autonomy for nations. They articulated a desire to be autonomous, to have their own self-determination, but realizing that that was not what the West had planned for them. They said, if you are going to stick us in this mandate program, you know, we beg you that it be the United States, because there was this understanding that the United States didn't have sort of imperial ambitions in the Middle East at the time. And they said, you know, as a distant second, it would be the United Kingdom, but please, 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 whatever you do, not the French. But Syria ended up with the French.
Aliyah, could I ask, what part of the problem is it that Assad and his father before him never explain anything? They are notoriously silent, almost invisible people. We're tough, we're mean, we know what we're doing, and now go away. We have no idea what the inheritor here is up to. We've never known.
Which we, the United States?
Yeah, the world, say.
I mean, listen, Syria was never strategically important in terms of resources. And so the United States has often been comfortable with strong men that, you know, keep things stable. And Syria under the Assads was to some extent stable and predictable. And, you know, the fact that we know so, you know, we are much more, we find much more compelling and are much more sort of riveted by the kind of like technicolor violence that actors like ISIS commit than we are at this sort of, the kind of violence that's committed by men who don't have the beards but wear nice Armani suits. And that's a mistake, because the violence that's been wreaked by the state on Syrians over the last 50 years is critical to understanding everything that happened in 2011 until today.
Can I introduce another guest, Mustafa? He's the young host of a podcast called Irrelevant Arabs. It's a program that puts Middle Eastern voices front and center on a variety of topics. Mustafa's own family is still in Syria, and so he prefers not to be identified by his last name. How do you lead your American friends, Mustafa, through this wilderness?
Hello, everyone. It's quite simple for me. While, yes, the historical implications of the French and the Ottomans are still very existent in the problems of Syria today, the number one and most brutal killer on the ground in Syria is Bashar al-Assad and his regime. So it's quite clear, it's simple for me, that no matter what put him there in the first place, or no matter what started the Assad regime 46 or some years ago, Bashar al-Assad still plays the most violent role in Syria. And everything else is an outcome of what they have done to this country. They have allowed a space in which extremism can flourish, by systematically destroying our educational systems, by systematically marginalizing communities that historically were very active in the political role of Syria. We're very active in revolutions, in kicking out the French and the British and the Ottomans. Mm. All these communities were cut off. And like I said, the space was created in which we have now the problems of ISIS. And we have a revolution that failed only because it had no political role whatsoever. They had to start from absolute zero.
We've known with good reason that Bashar al-Assad was responsible for 90%+ of the killing, the deaths in this long war. But what was to do about it? What did Syrians see as possible that we Americans despaired of after the war in Iraq? What might have been possible, Mustafa?
Well, what we saw possible was an absolute change, an earthquake that would shake the system that has rendered that made our parents silent of the atrocities of that happened around them. And we saw that one, we could, as a Syrian people, as an Arab people, take an active role in our politics. We could finally stop saying Israel is the only problem facing the Palestinian cause and say we have Palestinians in our own country who are, as Mali said, without documentation, who are suffering as if they were living under an occupation.
And Generation after generation.
Exactly. And it would have continued, and it will continue, unfortunately, now it seems how things are turning out.
Aliyah, Molly mentioned it, and I think we have to deal with it. What's become a commonplace argument now that President Obama lifted, you know, sanctions, or he didn't pursue the warning in Labor Day 2013, and he handed the country to the Soviet Union, I mean to Russia and to Iran. Is that a fair picture? Do you think, and do most Syrians believe it, that he was, that their country was abandoned by the United States at that moment?
I mean, I think that was one of the more clear, one of the moments when it came most clearly into focus. But at that point, there had been sort of wanton killing happening by the regime against the people for a full 2 years, and nothing other than lip service was really afforded.
Lip service on a slogan, Assad must go. A lot of people at the time thought that was just talk and nothing. And also that the price.
I think it's clear that the Obama administration wanted to conclude a deal with Iran, the primary benefactor of the regime. And the reason that the regime, one of the major reasons the regime didn't fall right away, was because Iran was backing it both economically, and militarily. And at the same time, the United States had decided, Obama, the administration, and you know, because let's just talk about things that are clear and that we don't have to have top secret access to know about. The Obama administration had decided to make a shift away from Saudi Arabia and towards Iran. It wanted to conclude this Iranian nuclear deal. And it was clear that the United States did not ask for anything in return for the deal in terms of Syria. So what is in Obama's heart, is not for me to tell you. But what is clear from his actions is that he was more than comfortable to get a deal with Iran without asking for anything in exchange for Syria.
I want to introduce also Yasser Munif. He writes and teaches post-colonial history of the Francophone world in particular at Emerson College. He was born in Syria, schooled in Lebanon, got his doctorate at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst. Welcome, Yasser. You know, I've been thinking all week, why do we find it so hard to talk about Syria? The answer is, A, it's so awful, but we don't know what in the world we could do about Syria. Not the bad old mafia regime that's been an embarrassment to all the Syrians I know for 40, 50 years, but after the Iraq War, what in the world might we have done? Do you want to jump in on that very simple, awkward question?
Sure. But I would like to start with some history. I think that it's important to explore the...
You're our historian. Go ahead.
The history of the Syrian regime. The Ba'ath Party took power in 1963 and has been in power since then. And one of the problems for the Assad regime is that Syria was a very vibrant democratic country for at least a decade before the Ba'ath took power. There were 270 publications, there were political parties, there were elections, and there was a civil society, very vibrant civil society. Mm. And there was also, on the other hand, a history of coup d'etat in Syria because of the geopolitical position of Syria and Israel and so on. There was a lot of many conspiracies in Syria, and the first coup d'etat was basically planned by the US, by the CIA. And so the Syrian regime had to tackle those issues, how to prevent any additional coup d'etat and how to crush the democratic forces. And very quickly, it crushed the leftist and secular forces. It crushed the unions that were very powerful and independent. And starting from the 1980, after a major massacre in Hama, the Syrian regime basically established a big prison, and anyone who opposed the regime was basically disappeared, tortured, killed, or exiled. And so there was a form of complete silence, and any political spaces were completely eradicated, and people were basically silenced completely. And if you asked any person in Syria, like the young generation, who was president before Assad, most of the people wouldn't be able to give an answer.
And what you mentioned the CIA, and I just got to pursue that. The question is, what do Syrians know? What do Syrians know about our involvement, going way back into the 50s?
So the Syrian people and the Arab people in general have a very bad relationship with the West in general because of the history of colonization, because of imperialism, because of the role that Israel played and its backers, the US and Britain and France. And so they have almost an intuitive kind of position or thinking toward the US, France, and Britain. They oppose those forces. And they know that those forces have been supporting dictatorship in the region for several decades, and that they fear any kind of democratic forces in the region because they are and they would be much more independent and they would make independent decision. And so they were opposing that kind of politics.
I want to ask Alia and then Mustafa, I mean, is this a general view? And I mean, it's never heard in this country, but do you buy it, Alia?
Listen, in Syria, there was not freedom of speech. There isn't particularly even freedom of speech within your own house, but that there are, like, within certain parameters, a way to express your frustration with the fact that you don't have much control over your life. You know, there are things that are acceptable. So, yes, it's easier to talk about the wrongs that Israel and the United States and the former colonial powers have committed against the Syrian people, as opposed to being able to talk clearly about, you know, also the major oppressor of the Syrian people, which is the regime. So, it's, you know, but, like, to what extent and to, you know, there at some point, like, you know, conspiracy theory also becomes larger than what the facts are. That's sort of something that's inevitable in a place where you don't have access to information and you don't have access to public forums where you can speak about things.
But I'm also thinking of the American hand in Syria as we speak.
I think
Mustafa.
Yes, I think I have to agree with Yasser. There is sort of an intuitive suspicion of any American role in the region, any Western role to be more specific. And America, in relationship to the Syrian people, did not help create a more wider image for itself after what it did in Iraq. So yes, there's always been a suspicion from their involvement, and that really played an important role during the revolution in terms of the question of intervention.
And yet, we also speak of a toolbox in the President Obama's White House that wasn't used. What might have been acceptable, might have worked, do you think?
In my opinion,
in an American role.
In my opinion, the question of intervention here in America has sort of fallen into the ideological realm of questions instead of it being a practical question. What is happening in Syria and what can be done to stop what? What needed to be stopped is a massive mass murder of an entire people. How could that been stopped? It could have been stopped by arming much of the rebel forces that existed in Syria at a very critical point in the revolution that were not the Saudi proxies, that were not the Islamic or the extremist factions that were pure Syrian revolutionaries who stand up and believe for were fighting for a very equal and liberated Syria, liberated from all oppression and all its kinds. That could have been a tool that could have been used. Why was ISIS left to grow? While we all know very well that America was very capable of seeing and monitoring its movement, whether through its allies or through through military technology that exists today, why weren't these rebel groups on the ground in Syria who were calling for the world to arm them not allowed arms, so that the reason for that was always given was that we don't want these weapons to fall into the wrong hands. But ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, all these very extremist factions were a lot more able to access black markets in the world due to their experience in other world wars. But the actual Syrian rebels did not have that experience and ended up getting strangled in their own revolution.
Mustafa, stand by. And Alia, I know you've got to leave. Thank you for being with us. Yasser Munif, we're coming right back. We're talking about Syria and specifically symptoms of zombification in Syria and among the rest of us. This is Open Source. For most of a decade, Syria has been a war zone of many fronts and many levels, none of them settled. The thought this hour was to catch what it means, what it feels like to Syrians. We spoke earlier this week with Marwan Hisham, who has been Molly Crabapple's native guide in Syria and co-author of their chronicle, Brotherhood of the Gun. Marwan grew up in Raqqa, and he kept teaching English there during the war that ISIS won and then lost to make Raqqa the capital of its new caliphate. The war made him a freelance reporter on the devastation of his country. One of the stories he told me was about the sad fate of Aleppo, the ancient city where he had gone to university.
It was a scene I've never seen before. Literally, I can say like 99% of the buildings in all of these neighborhoods were hit. Many of them totally destroyed. These neighborhoods were very, very crowded with people back in the days. You see them now, like, almost empty, except for very, very few cars. I mean, it's heartbreaking. It is, you walk in those streets, you walk in denial. This cannot be the reality. You know, where are all those people suddenly? Where are all these buildings? A city cannot be dead. I kept walking in hysteria for days, not being able to imagine that, you know, such a very, very, very crowded city full of life can turn into this, almost an apocalyptic scene. Yeah, and people, you see them damaged, like really damaged, just like, you know, how those buildings were damaged.
Marwan, does anybody explain what is going on, why the government is doing this? Does the government admit it's doing it? What is the public reason for all this?
The government views everyone who took arm against it as people who were paid by imperial powers to destroy the regime. We're talking in the context of the Arab Spring. The government portrays it as terrorist haven, where everyone there is a terrorist, basically. And then when they get criticism that, you know, civilians are dying, they start to say, no, we're only killing terrorists. And all these photos and videos you see are fabricated. Assad himself, like when he talks about Syrians, you feel like he means by Syrians are those Syrians who are loyal to him. Yeah, like the rest of the Syrians do not exist simply. And this is astonishing.
On his way through the ruins of Aleppo, Marwan said he had asked his driver why a man over there was sitting out alone in front of his auto repair shop that had been entirely destroyed.
When he was driving me and I saw the guy sitting in front of his shop where everything around him is destroyed. And I said, wait a minute, let me look at this. yeah, it's an open show by a mechanic there, and yeah, like there's no one around. So I was like, you know, what's this? Does he think that someone would come to him to, you know,
to get his car fixed, you mean?
Yeah. And I was like, you know, is this madness? Like, what's this? And he said, well, this is Aleppo. It's very unique situation, very sad and tragic.
That was Marwan Hisham. Yes, sir, I'm just fascinated by the man who just said, you know, he's wandering through what was once a crowded city around his university, and he just plain didn't believe it. I don't believe I'm seeing what I'm seeing. And I know what he means.
So what happened in Aleppo is that the city was completely destroyed. It's in ruins right now. And what's also interesting is that people during the revolution were able to create an entire revolutionary culture, and they created institution underground. So you would go to certain areas, certain neighborhoods that are completely destroyed, and yet underground you have playground, you have a cine club, you have kitchens, you have libraries and so on, and you have activists organizing and planning and so on. I think that's, you know, the aspect of the Syrian revolution that was completely dismissed, that was invisible, almost unthinkable. And people have a tendency to reduce what's happening in Syria and in the Arab world to chaos and destruction and violence. I think it's much more than that. And people were able to create very important and creative institution and culture. And they were experimenting with different tools in the liberated areas. I mean, just imagine that the Syrian regime, the army, the police, the bureaucracy leaves a city, a big city with 300,000, 400,000 people overnight, and people have to recreate the institutions. And they have to do that with the bombing and the violence, the daily violence of the Syrian regime. So I think what happened in Syria is an incredible grassroots experimentation, very creative and very inspiring. And yet, that's not necessarily what the media is interested in. And that's not necessarily the image of the Syrian revolution that people have.
This is the life goes on moral and a projection into the future that I know we want to talk about. Do you want to comment on that, Mustafa? Just the testimony from Aleppo?
Yes, I think what Yasser was talking about was very important. Aleppo became... The sad fact is that we normalized the destruction that was around us. People had to live on. Life had to go on. And I remember there was a young man on one of the front lines who was called Express, because during the day he fought and during the night he drove around a little coffee cart to keep all the other Free Syrian Army soldiers awake by serving them hot coffee. It is kind of a surreal scene down there, I guess, would be what to say.
Talk about surreal and the future. I just have to ask you about, you know, whether something much worse than all of this could be sprung upon us any moment. I mean, the Saudis are talking, I mean, they kidnapped the Prime Minister of Lebanon and they've said they'd love to destroy Hezbollah in the heart of Beirut because, you know, this is a way of dealing with Hezbollah, but also with Syria, also with Iran. And nobody quite denies it. Israel would be in on it. The United States would be in on it. Is this crazy?
Something. Yes. I think what's happening right now is the whole media world is looking to place Syria in a sort of linear perspective where a war begins and ends. But the reality is there is no – the war is only getting worse. And we will see a lot more worse. There is a people who have went down to the streets and called for a revolution whose demands were not met. That struggle continues. And in a regional sense, it doesn't seem like anyone's coming to an agreement over what's going on in Syria. We see Turkey's involvement brutally against the Kurdish front in Syria, and we see Israel getting more and more aggressive. And yes, we only see it getting worse and worse.
Yes, sir, do you buy that? I mean, this is what tortures me, the thought that nobody's looking for a resolution, nobody's looking for a way out, nobody's looking for a rationalization of anything.
I think that the violence in Syria is monumental. I think it's unprecedented. And I think part of the reason is that the Syrian revolution had many, many enemies. The neighboring countries were very scared of the implications of the Syrian revolution. If the Syrian revolution had succeeded in Syria and imposed the Syrian kind of democracy, Saudi Arabia would have been threatened and all the neighboring countries would have been threatened by that democracy. And that's why we see so much violence in Syria. Everyone wants to crush the Syrian revolution, and any potential democracy that might emerge in that region, in Syria and beyond. I think that it's very easy to contaminate the entire region if there is a kind of democracy in Syria. Mm. And that was the priority for the Saudi, for the Turks, for all the neighboring countries, including the U.S. The U.S. was not really interested in any kind of democracy, any kind of peace in the region. They were interested in keeping some kind of despotic regime, and they were interested in preserving the Syrian regime, Assadism without Assad. So getting rid of the head of the regime, Assad, but keeping really the military and the security and the police and all that. And that's what we are witnessing, unfortunately, in the Syrian context and also in the Arab world.
You all are picturing a much more violent Syria today than we read about, where the line is generally that Assad won, the Russians won, and ISIS lost. How do we know he won? Why do they say he won? And who says ISIS is gone? Do you want to grab at that, Mustafa?
I think in terms of ISIS, the war on ISIS has been portrayed as a victory because it benefits America that it is portrayed as a victory. But the reality of the war on ISIS is that ISIS was never a state to be crushed. The name, the Islamic State, is an aspirational name. ISIS is a cancer that has spread throughout the country and was protected by international powers and allowed to grow to a point where it ate this revolution from the inside. And today, when ISIS's role in doing that has ended, America tried to exterminate it by bombing Raqqa and bombing al-Mosul and trying to push it out of these areas. But we know for a fact from a history of extremist factions existing all over in Iraq and in Afghanistan and in Syria that it's very simple for them to blend back into the background, and they are much more effective as splinter cells here and there than they are. So I do not see that there has been a victory over ISIS. Hopefully there will be, but that can only come from the rebels, the Syrian activists who fight for their country and for their version of a liberated Syria. As for the war between Bashar al-Assad and the rebels, yes, he may have won a military battle, but like I said, again, this is not a linear process. When I said to you that we continue to fight in many different ways. Cultural revolutions are happening all over throughout the Syrian population. And yes, this may sound dreamy and all that, but it's not. It is effective. The future generations will know. We will protect the story of this revolution, and we will not let it be written as a war against terror. We will remind people that this man mass murdered his population, and for he may win this battle, he will not unseed what we have planted in Syria.
Could I just throw it out, Yasser? It's a serious question, that part of what troubles us about this 8 years of war in Syria is that we feel the symptoms even here, but almost everywhere. Sort of bullies rampant, fighters out of control, the war impulse unchecked, really, a kind of choose-your-truth society, deny, deny, deny. There's a kind of seed of a universal madness there. Possible?
Yeah, the Syrian regime actually and the Russian declared victory twice so far. And it's very similar to, back I think in 2004 when Bush declared victory and had this mission accomplished banner behind him. Mm. And we all know what happened since then. An ongoing war for more than 10 years now in Iraq. with no end in sight. And same thing with Afghanistan. And I think the same is true in Syria, unless there is a second wave of revolutionary forces emerging. And I think there is a very good chance that this might happen in the region. The revolutionary forces are still vibrant and around and organizing. I mean, every time a revolt or a mass movement or grassroots organizing is crushed, we see it emerging somewhere else in Syria and beyond in the Arab world. Just recently in Morocco and in Iran and in Jordan and so on. So this revolutionary wave, I think, is going to go on. And I think there is an end to this despotic regime or order in the region, very much similar to the way that
forgive me, go ahead.
Similar to the end of the socialist camp when they crumbled, when they fall down. I think that the Syrian regime is reaching its end. But that's going to take, obviously, much more time and energy.
I want to believe you're right, but I got to note that nobody in the scene, it's symptomatic of the age, is offering to be helpful. I mean, out of Europe, out of Russia, there's no suggestion that, as in 2013, the United States and Russia ought to be engaged together on this. But nobody's suggesting that. I don't know. Where's the positive push among the kinds of authorities that we used to rely on? The UN, for that matter, since Kofi Annan lost the thread, they're not a player either.
I mean, the U.S. is not interested in seeing a democratic regime emerging in the region, in Syria or anywhere in the Arab world. And I don't think that they're going to support any revolutionary or democratic forces in the region. On the contrary, they're going to oppose them and undermine them and challenge them, as we have seen in the past 8 years in Syria, 7 years. So that's going to take some time. I think that social forces and cultural modalities take time to change. It doesn't happen overnight. People are still learning how to transform their societies. They experienced 40 years of basically oppression and with no political spaces where they can express themselves. And only recently they were able to finally engage in the political arena.
I want to give my fellow podcaster, Mustafa, the last word here. What do you tell your audience, Mustafa, especially Americans, that we've got to know, we've got to be prepared for, we've got to rethink about Syria?
I always say, first of all, it's very important to know that Syria is flowing out into the rest of the world. From what we've saw allowed
that's
to
the bad
happen
news.
In Syria. That's the you want the good news?
No, I'm
afraid I can't help you there. I don't know. So it's important to know that we can feel the rise of fascism, the rise of bullying, like you said, the emboldening of totalitarian states and the emboldening of oppressive states like what Israel is doing to Gaza right now is unspeakable. It's important to remember that at some point in history, a nation stood up for freedom, and every government in the world was against its freedom and it's against its democracy. So I think we have to get ready to really take the reins on this world that we live in and really do something about it, or else we're all going to end up, from America to Syria, under totalitarian regimes that respect very little of our freedoms.
A last word, Yasser Munif.
I think it's a long-term battle, and I think that the Syrian people and the Arab people will prevail. It's not going to be easy, and it's a multiple-front kind of battle. But I think that we should be hopeful because of what we have seen in the past 5 or 7 years in Syria and the Arab world.
Wow. That's a moral I would have imagined, that we should look at the last 5 years and be hopeful.
And yet, I think there is so much to unearth and comprehend in Syria.
We're going to unearth it and listen with you. Thank you, Yasser Munif, Alia Malek, and Mustafa of the Irrelevant Arabs podcast. Thanks also to Molly Crabapple and Marwan Hisham. You can see some of Molly's images on our website, radioopensource.org. And while you're there, sign up for our bonus podcast feed, on Patreon. You might even think of making a donation. We rely on listeners like you to support our work. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Becca DiGregorio, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer, Mary McGrath's our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon.